From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, the right to work tidal wave engulfs Michigan. We look at the possible fallout.
The problem is the way in which it was done, and the Republicans, I think, will pay some long-term cost for that.
Plus, we explore unreal estate, possibilities and opportunities created by the vacant homes and lots in Detroit.
When people leave homes and when businesses fail and when property values decline, the buildings and the property that they occupy become available to be used and occupied and appropriated in different ways.
And we take you to Isle Royal, where the wolf population is barely hanging on.
That mournful, lonely howl, it does really send shivers up and down your back.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, we travel to Isle Royal. Researchers have been watching the wolves and moose on this remote Michigan island for more than 50 years. We'll hear why, on this protected island, the wolf population is barely hanging on. And we'll speak with the author of a new book on the so-called urban pioneers of Detroit. But first, what a week it was. On Thursday, right to work was introduced in both Michigan's House and Senate. And after months, years really, of Governor Snyder saying the issue was not on his agenda, that it was too divisive, he now says he will sign right to work into law. Protesters poured into the state capitol on Thursday. They turned up over the weekend, and thousands more are vowing to be there tomorrow when more votes are expected to take place. Let's try to put this into context as we turn to Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry and Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, I'd like to start with you. The sense of history here is really overwhelming, the idea of Michigan going right to work. What is your sense of what all this will mean for our state?
Well, I think it is historic if it indeed plays out the way it appears it's going to play out with such alarming speed. But I kind of view this in the context of what I've been writing about for, I don't know, the last 5 or 6 years, is the reckoning that's going on in Michigan in terms of it trying to come to terms with its post-war industrial past. And that, of course, was crystallized by the implosion of the Detroit auto industry. And in some senses, I think this is an extension of that. The UAW particularly has become dramatically weaker. It's dramatically smaller. When I started covering the auto industry, it had about 750,000 members. Now it's in the order of about 350,000, down from 1.5 million in 1979, so it continues to shrink. And I think this is also indicative of the political divide in our country we're seeing in a lot of different places, whether it's in Washington over the fiscal cliff or in state houses around the country. We've seen it in Wisconsin. We've seen it in Ohio. And now we're in Indiana and now in Michigan. And I think this is going to continue to play out this way. And, you know, the governor himself, yes, he did say it was too divisive. And I think if he were sitting here talking to us privately, he'd probably still say that. But circumstances, I think, pushed him in this direction.
Well, I think that I don't disagree with anything Dan said, really, but the problem is the way in which it was done, and the Republicans, I think, will pay some long-term cost for that. I've never seen a case where we had a bill this momentous that was just sort of rammed through both houses in a day without any substantial debate. It reminded me of some kind of an Eastern European communist that used to do those things in those legislatures. And they did it for I think the governor was originally right. It's kind of hard to see why, other than to punish the unions for Proposal 2, why it was necessary. The unions are indeed weak. The unions are sort of losing clout. And what we don't know is what the long-term political cost will be. These bills are going to be, I can't see any way that they're not going to be passed and they're not going to be signed. And it could be Republicans will pay a long-term price. The Detroit Free Press yesterday, the editorial almost sounded like a letter from a jilted lover. That you betrayed us, they said, and you let us down. But on the other hand, we may remember 20 years ago, John Engler took some very radical steps with closing mental institutions, putting people on the street, and people predicted he'd be a one-term governor, and he got more than 60% when he ran for re-election. So we simply don't know.
I think part of the calculation of doing this right now, Cynthia, is that they've got a bigger majority now in lame duck than they're going to have, obviously, in the next session. And I think there's a hope that with 2 years out before the next general election, that there will make some, so there will be some traction here, and that Snyder will survive. I've talked to some people who are closely associated with this, and I think in general the feeling is that this is a risk worth taking, and they think that he and the Republicans can survive this 2 years out. I think that's a big guess on their part at this point, so we have to wait and see.
The problem is this. The problem is that this, in a way, thumbs their nose at the voters and the result of the election. The election in Michigan, the presidential election, wasn't close at all. Romney lost by almost 10 points. If the Democrats and the unions hadn't been so ham-handed and wasted money in the wrong places, they might well have picked up the state House. In any event, that is what Wright. This probably would not have passed in the new House. We had six Republicans who voted against Right to Work. There's going to be five fewer Republicans next time, and some of those who voted for it in the lame duck might find it harder, or their successors in the full session. So, again, this is kind of going against the will of the voters, but how that'll play out, we'll have to see. And before this, we're talking about politically in Governor Snyder.
Yeah.
Before this, it was pretty much assumed as a given that he was going to win re-election in 2014 without any real difficulty at all. That's not to say that he won't. I still think the odds favor him, but this presents more problems for him.
Well, what do you see ahead for the months and the weeks ahead? I would suspect recall efforts are going to start bubbling up.
I don't think so. I mean, they may try to recall a couple state legislators. You can't recall a governor. We'd have to get practically 1.1 million signatures. It just isn't feasible.
How about lawsuits?
I mean, look what's happened in the city of Detroit. And by the way, I think that is probably one of the things that has pushed Snyder in this direction as well, is the continual trench fighting with unions in Detroit. Every step of the way, every attempt to try and engineer a financial workout for the city has been blocked by the unions and the courts. And I have no doubt that we're going to see that going forward here. I don't know what those strategies exactly will be, but you can bet they're going to do everything they can to try and block it. And there is a 90-day waiting period from the time this thing is going to be signed to the time it becomes effective. So I think there's going to be a lot of trench fighting back and forth.
Well, Dan's right. In the 90-day, by the time this thing becomes effective, they'll have had to deal with Detroit one way or another. Mm-hmm. While Right to Work may help eventually with the public sector unions, that's not an immediate fix for the problem in Detroit. The puzzlement to me is that you would think, and they may still get them done, but there are some things before the legislature, namely an emergency manager, a new emergency manager provision of some kind for Detroit, that are much more urgent than Right to Work would have been. I think to some extent that while Snyder certainly was upset with the unions over Proposal 2, and upset is a euphemism, he decided to jump on the back of the tiger rather than being pulled along. I think this thing was going to be passed whether he wanted it to be or not.
In fact, I think we both know that to be the case. He was being pushed forward to this conclusion.
But does he now look weak to you that he had said, I'm not going there, it's not on my agenda, oh, now I'm on the back of the tiger? Can that be viewed now? Is he very much weakened?
I don't think so. I really don't think so. It depends on how things play out. You remember, Cindy, just 2 years ago, President Obama was terribly weakened. The Republicans won this huge victory in the congressional elections. 2 years later, he wins re-election pretty darn easily. So anybody who says they know what's going to happen in November 2014 has no idea what they're talking about.
Well, and I think the other element here is the economy, and as goes the national economy. I mean, you've got car companies and an auto industry that are making more money than they've made in anybody's memory here. And they're adding jobs. They're adding shifts. There is a lot of private investment going on in the city of Detroit. So what Snyder may have going for him here is some economic momentum going forward. Now, we'll have to see what happens with fiscal cliff and what happens in the new year in Washington and what effect, if any, that has on consumer sentiment, et cetera. But this is what happens to politicians. I mean, Jennifer Granholm happened to be governor when the implosion began in the auto industry, and there was very little that she could do. It was sucking everything right down with her. This is a different situation that Snyder's in, and he may be able to ride this up. And if he does, and if the business community does rally around this, as some people say that they will, then that will help him, I think.
One of the things that Governor Snyder said Thursday as he announced, yes, I'm going to sign this, is he is now for Right to Work because it will make Michigan more competitive. I'd like to get the thoughts of both of you on how true you think this really is. Jack, I'd like to start with you.
There's really no evidence of that. Bridge Magazine, the Center for Michigan's online publication, had a story, comprehensive story, a week ago that said there's really no evidence really one way or another. There is evidence that right-to-work states have lower wage levels, whether because of right-to-work or other factors may be disputable, but there's no clear sign that right-to-work states are doing a lot better in attracting jobs, and some signs that they're not doing as well.
Well, I think it depends on how you look at it. If you look in the context of the auto industry and investment, I don't think there's any question that most of the new plants, particularly by foreign automakers, have all gone in right-to-work states. There is a belief, and I underscore the word belief, there's a belief that once Michigan becomes right-to-work, you're going to see a Toyota or a Volkswagen or a Nissan or whatever plant opening in Michigan. I would not bet my paycheck on that. But, you know, there's a lot of statistics back and forth that people look at Oklahoma and make the argument that Oklahoma has added more jobs and per capita income has grown more. The other thing you have to look at is that Michigan's per capita income over the last decade has dropped like a stone. And it's starting to climb back, but it's got a very long way to go. Now, the question is whether right to work is going to have much impact on it. And I don't think we necessarily know. And Jack's right, some of this is speculative. I don't think there's any question but what there are some businesses, when they're looking at investment, that are more attracted to right-to-work states, particularly if the kind of work that they're in is more susceptible to union organization. But clearly, a lot of 21st-century high-tech kind of investment is really not a union issue, and it's not something that they're plagued by.
One thing we should keep in mind is that in the private sector, even in Michigan, it's only about 12.4% of workers are unionized, and this may have a far bigger impact, as Daniel alluded earlier, on the public sector, where 55% of workers are unionized. We're talking about teachers, government workers, folks like that.
Right, and I think that's really where this is going to have an impact. And really, you know, we've got about 17.5% of the workforce in Michigan is unionized. So this assumption that you have, particularly outside the state, people have that this is labor stronghold the way it was 30 and 40 and 50 years ago is simply not true.
And we're speaking with Daniel House, Detroit News business columnist, and Jack Lessenberry, political analyst here at Michigan Radio. We'll take a quick break. Then we'll continue our conversation about this historic right-to-work legislation in Michigan. We'll continue to explore what comes next for unions in our state, what it means for the Democratic Party, which for so long has relied on labor. Then we travel to northern Michigan, very northern, to Isle Royale, right in Lake Superior, with the Environment Report's Rebecca Williams. That's in 15 minutes. You're listening to Stateside here on Michigan Radio. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We're talking with Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry and Detroit News business columnist Daniel House, exploring the impact of the state legislature taking up right-to-work bills and, of course, Governor Rick Snyder saying that when they hit his desk, he will sign them. Jack, I want to turn to the relationship now between labor and the Democratic Party here in our state. Now, in the face of the very likely prospect that Michigan will become the 24th right-to-work state, what do you think union leaders and Democrats will do or should do next? Do they go from defense to offense?
I think that this may be the silver lining for the unions is that they need to reinvent themselves. Even without this, for many years, they've been going downhill. They've gone from something like 35% of the private sector workforce nationally to 7%. And so this may just be accelerating the decline, and it really... Labor, I think, has not had a visionary leader in this country in many years. They haven't had any kind of a forward-looking strategy other than to huddle and try to protect what they have, which they're losing slowly. So hopefully they will look at this as a wake-up call on how do we reinvent ourselves. I wouldn't bet on that, but that's what they certainly need to do.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wouldn't bet on it either, Jack. I mean, I really think that unions, the way they are built, are very resistant to change, and it's very difficult for them to move unless they are forced to. And I mean, clearly the best example of that here was in the auto bailouts. And the unions did move and swallowed a lot of concessions and renegotiated their contracts in a way that they otherwise never would have. Now, whether this is the kind of galvanizing event, I think that remains to be seen. One of the things you saw in Wisconsin was once membership became voluntary, people fled the union in droves. And I think that what we need to really focus on here is that one of the real issues is this is a way to hurt the unions financially. And that is what, because I think a lot of Republicans and a lot of union leaders know that if their members have the option of leaving the union and still getting the benefit of some of the union negotiated benefits and wages, people will do that.
I think that's true. On the other hand, while this may be a blow to the unions, it may also be a blow to the Republican Party. And if you look at Wisconsin, where Scott Walker put in these reforms and where he himself survived the recall, Paul Ryan was the Republican vice presidential nominee. They were blown out by Obama in the November election. Republicans, generally, they're going to pay some kind of a price. We don't know how much of a price it is, but Snyder will not win election, probably, if he wins, by as many votes as he would have otherwise.
I think you're probably right, and I think that the people who are making these decisions deciding to go ahead figure that it's worth the risk. And you know, I had a conversation with one person who made that point very clear to me. You know, if we don't take advantage of this opportunity now, we may not get this opportunity again. And certainly wouldn't even have as good of an opportunity come January. So I think that's why they've done it this way. I clearly understand why people have criticized the way they are trying to do this and how, you know, it's kind of this sneak attack approach. That's very obvious why people are unhappy with it.
As Michiganders, what were your thoughts as you saw the scene unfold on Wednesday? There's pepper spray. The doors of the Capitol are locked. There are people pounding on doors. What were your thoughts just as Michigan citizens?
Well, I think my main thought, as I said before, was that this is a disgraceful way to smash something of this consequence through the legislature. One state senator told me they had more deliberative action last time they wanted a new commemorative license plate. And so that bothered me regardless. In fact, if no matter how I would feel about the issue, doing it that way was sort of unseemly. In fact, there's probably it'll be interesting to see this week how much more protest activity we have.
You know, I kind of viewed it as exactly what I expected. I've covered a lot of this stuff in Michigan over the last decade or 15 years and have seen these kinds of reactions and in fact have written many columns suggesting that going right to work was going to be a fight that might not be worth having, particularly when you've got the economic pressure that you do have on the state, on the cities, and on the private sector. There's been a lot of change that has been driven by economic reality in this state in the last 5 or so years. And I think you're going to get this kind of pushback, and it's going to be fierce, and it's not just going to be from the unions. It's going to be from the national media. It's going to be from the National Democratic Party. It's probably going to be from the President of the United States. And the question you have to answer, and I don't think we know the answer to this, is does this derail the direction that Michigan is on, or does it accelerate it?
Dan, Jack, thanks so much, as always, for sharing your perspectives.
Always a pleasure.
Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst, and Daniel Howes, business columnist at the Detroit News. Picking up now on the comments from Jack about the way in which the right-to-work bills rocketed through the State House and Senate, the word steamroller has been used in many columns and editorials over the weekend. The speed at which Republicans moved through this most controversial of issues meant there were no hearings, no public comments. Craig Ruff has seen a legislative battle, or two or three, during his 11 years working for Governor William Milliken and Lieutenant Governor James Brickley. These days, he's a senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Craig, welcome.
Well, thanks a lot for having me.
Craig, when was the last time that you can remember anything of this magnitude being jammed through this way?
You know, there's a five-letter word. It's never.
Oh.
I cannot ever recall anything of this consequence being rushed through this fast with so little committee work, in fact, no committee work to speak of. So in terms of the product, the consequences of a right to work in Michigan, that's one issue. Mm-hmm. The other, however, is the process, and this one is as speedy as anything I've ever seen.
And what consequences do you think will come from this?
One consequence, I think, will be that future legislatures and governors may look at this as a precedent and say to themselves, we've got the power, let's act fast before we lose control. So it's more, I think, a procedural shift that we may be seeing more commonly acted out in Lansing. You know, Governor Snyder has ever, in fact, even on the campaign trail, talked about how many things he wanted to get done, and he kept saying, I want to act in dog years. This has been more like a fly year.
Yeah. And one of the other things he said often, campaign trail and since, is that his governorship was going to be based on a premise of bipartisan cooperation. What do you think about that going forward, the likelihood of that continuing?
That's scary. And I'll tell you what. He's got 2 years left in his first term. He's going to face a House that has a few more, five more Democrats than currently, but with still a healthy Republican majority. But without Democratic support on key issues, like, for example, any funding relief for the city of Detroit or gas tax or something that would increase funding for the maintenance of Michigan roads, he's going to need Democratic votes because he doesn't have all 59 Republicans in the future legislature in the House behind all of these new policy initiatives. So he would have benefited greatly from having the last 2 years of his first term be years in which there's bipartisanship in the legislature. And I can't help but believe he's not going to find any friendly audience on the Democratic side.
Hmm. Would you envision any rewards, any rewards for Governor Snyder for this about-face and this sudden action?
I found that the public does appreciate strong leadership, even when they question whether the product is good. They like decisiveness. So kudos to the governor and the Republicans in the legislature for being decisive, regardless of what you may think of right to work. We're seeing the stalemate in Washington, D.C. over this so-called fiscal cliff.
Mm-hmm.
And with each passing day, I think the public in America says to themselves, how come they can't get this thing done? What's the problem? Why the impasse? They, in this sense, on the Washington front, would love to see the speed with which we did right to work or are doing right to work. On the Washington front, we'd be overjoyed
to see things actually cook along and actually happen. But you raised an interesting point, Craig Ruff, with respect to the process. And I wonder if, as you say, future governors and future legislatures can look at this, go to school on this, and do the same. What price do you think we just as citizens in the state of Michigan are going to pay for what's an obvious lack of transparency?
We pay a very healthy price, and that is that our confidence in the openness of the democratic process is now chipped away.
Mm-hmm.
May not be completely obliterated, but there will be a loss of public confidence in just the openness of government, the openness of the public bodies of the Senate and the House. The other thing I think one would logically argue is that the public has not had its seat at the table. It hasn't had the opportunity to go to committee meetings and committee hearings to give testimony. Instead, the public is kind of reduced in its role to that of a demonstrator on the Capitol grounds.
And I was wondering about your thoughts, having worked for many years in Lansing, having watched state government for so many years. What were your thoughts as a citizen of Michigan watching the doors being locked last Thursday, the pepper spray, the protests? What did you think of that?
Well, it took me back to Wisconsin of a year ago, where demonstrators basically took over the building and held fort and slept overnight and had their meals delivered. They did some damage to the Wisconsin State Capitol. I fear similar types of either damage to the building or massive disruption in downtown Lansing to be just kind of a natural course. And it saddened me last week to have the Capitol closed off. It's interesting. If you If you visit Lansing and let's say you want to meet with somebody in the Michigan Department of Treasury,
mm-hmm.
and you go to the Treasury building, you've got to pass through security. You got to give your driver's license to the police officer. You got to get escorted to the office that you're heading toward. But our state capitol is wide open. Anybody can walk in virtually at any time of the day or night. There's no frisking. You don't have to pass through a security officer or booth. So it's sort of a testimony of state government in Michigan being a very open building. And when it's closed, it's more than just a metaphor for how people are being distanced from the actions being taken on Right to Work.
Craig Ruff is a senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants, having worked for Governor William Milliken and Lieutenant Governor James Brickley. Craig, thanks for your insights today.
Hey, my pleasure.
Let's now travel to a place in Michigan so remote you can only get there by ferry or seaplane. The place, an island in Lake Superior, Isle Royal. It's mostly wilderness. Cell phones don't work there. Wolves and moose have the run of the island. The Environment Report's Rebecca Williams had the chance to visit Isle Royal. She discovered it's an ideal place for people who study the big mammals.
A 9-month-old calf. Looks like it might have just fallen down that rocky edge and never got up.
Rolf Peterson has come across a moose skeleton. Morning cloak butterflies are lapping up sodium from the bones. With a yank and a twist, Peterson rips off the skull.
I think it's least disruptive if we just saw off the back leg.
Every bone tells a story. Peterson can tell how the moose lived and how it died. He can tell whether it fell and broke its ribs, whether it starved, or was killed by wolves.
And then we look for any abnormalities in any of the bones, and particularly how big it was and what its early developmental history and nutritional history was, which is key to its adult health.
Over the past 54 years, researchers have collected more than 4,000 moose skeletons on the island. The bones offer clues about the moose population and about the wolves. Wolves got here by crossing an ice bridge from Ontario in the late 1940s. This study of wolves and moose is the longest-running study in the world of a predator and its prey. Rolf Peterson has been involved for 42 years of the study. He's been here through the brutal black fly summers and the harshest winters. He and his wife, Candy, live in an old fishing cabin on the island for much of the year. Wolves are secretive on the island. Candy Peterson says it's unusual to see them.
It's really much more fun to hear them, because you can hear them without their knowing that you're listening. That mournful, lonely howl, it does really send shivers up and down your back.
Rolf Peterson and other scientists spend the winters flying over the island in a little two-seat plane. They watch and count the wolves and moose from the air. Over the years, they've seen the wolf and moose populations boom and crash. This past winter, the wolf population dropped from 16 wolves down to its lowest point ever. Just 9.
Yeah, that's kind of a big red flag. There are apparently 2 females. So 2 out of 9, yeah, they're just hanging by their teeth. And so, yeah, in high risk of extinction.
The researchers discovered that 3 of the wolves died by falling into an old mine shaft on the island. But it's unclear what happened to the other 4. Peterson says there could be a few reasons why the wolf population has been sinking over the past 6 years. The wolves are highly inbred, and Peterson says it's unlikely that new wolves will come here on their own because fewer ice bridges are forming in our warmer climate. There's a shortage of the old moose that wolves like to eat, and a fatal disease called canine parvovirus could be hurting the wolves. If the wolves die off, it'll be up to the National Park Service to decide whether or not to reintroduce wolves to Isle Royal. Long-term studies like these are extremely rare. Rolf Peterson says there are all kinds of hurdles, financial, logistic, political. But he says studies that last this long give us a more complete picture of how nature works.
The answers that you get after 10 or 20 or 30 or 50 years are entirely different from what they would have been after 5 years. I mean, you get sometimes the opposite conclusion. So that makes you very cautious about saying what we know for sure.
He says this study has something going for it that a lot of studies don't: widespread public interest in the project. He credits people's fascination with wolves and moose with saving the study several times when it could have ended. For Stateside, I'm Rebecca Williams.
Be sure to join us tomorrow as our series continues. We'll hear why researchers on Isle Royal count on citizen scientists to hike off-trail in the wilderness with those biting bugs and wild weather to find moose bones. In the meantime, you can find out more about Rebecca's trip to Isle Royal. Just go online, michiganradio.org. Still to come, we talk with architecture professor Andrew Hersher about his new book, The Unreal Estate Guide to Detroit. That's right, Unreal Estate Guide. And coming up after the break, we visit a place in Detroit called Tech Shop that provides a space for carpenters, welders, designers, and other creative types. Stay with us. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's say you want to shape up and get fit, but you don't have the equipment. Well, you probably would get a gym membership. What if you want to create something, but don't have a workshop or the tools to make it happen? Well, there's a place in Detroit called Tech Shop, and it functions a lot like a gym for carpenters, welders, designers, and the like. Stateside's Emily Fox takes us there.
Well, welcome to Tech Shop.
I'm getting a tour of Tech Shop from Scott Barrels. Guess what his job title is? No, it's not assistant or representative. It's dream consultant, meaning he can help people build just about anything here.
We sort of consider this the gateway drug to the rest of the shop, because once you get into this, you're going to get into everything else.
Tech Shop is a new facility that recently opened up in Allen Park near Detroit. Members pay about $100 a month to access hundreds of thousands of dollars in tools and equipment. They can also take any of the 100 or so classes offered every month to teach members how to use the tools. Tech Shop is a space to allow people to create without needing to do a lot of upfront investment. And that's what drew this guy to Tech Shop.
Oh, well, my name is Luciano Golian. I'm from Italy, and I'm a maker of stringed musical instruments.
Luciano Golia had been making instruments in Italy for 25 years.
So it's basically a small bass.
Then he fell in love with a woman from Michigan, and they had a daughter. He moved to the U.S., but for the first few months after he moved here, he didn't have a place to work on his craft. He wasn't sure if his new family would stay in the Detroit area, so he didn't want to invest in building a workshop, and he still didn't have all the tools he needed to build his wooden instruments.
And the Tech Shop, it's an easy solution about a big problem. This was the most great solution, saving a lot of money for us as a family, absolutely.
Tech Shop got started in California by a guy who was the science advisor to the show Mythbusters. He did tests to see if myths were valid, myths like if you shoot a bullet straight up in the air, will you get killed by it coming down? Tech Shop CEO Mark Hatch says Mythbusters inspired the idea behind Tech Shop.
After he left Mythbusters, he didn't have access to all of the tools that he needed access in order to work on his projects. So out of that need came Tech Shop.
There are tech shops already in California, North Carolina, and Texas. It was Ford Motor Company that got Tech Shop to come to Michigan. Bill Coughlin is president and CEO of Ford Global Technologies. He's the one who gave Tech Shop a call.
What I wanted to do was encourage innovation at Ford, find a way to help commercialize technology, not just from Ford, but for the industry, and would include Tech Shop members. And, you know, if we could create new businesses in this area, that would be wonderful.
As an incentive for Tech Shop to come to Michigan and as an incentive to spur more innovation at Ford, Ford gives away 500 Tech Shop memberships to employees on a rotating basis every 3 months. And it looks like Ford's plan to spur innovation in the manufacturing industry is already panning out.
I'm a Tech Shop member, and I'm here working on the Volvo Stirling engine project.
This is Tim Sefton. He's an engineer, entrepreneur, and president of his company, Volo Designs.
It's a part I'm making.
It used the crowdfunding website Kickstarter to help fund this project. It's a new engine design that will run off of heat rather than gasoline. Sefton considers Tech Shop a part of his office and uses some pretty complex machines and equipment in the building.
So I'm going to put it in the mill and just turn it down.
He says it's interesting to be constantly surrounded by a wide range of people and projects at Tech Shop.
You get people from the artist community, you get people from the engineering community, you get people from the entrepreneurial world who are interested in, you know, testing out a new prototype.
And Mark Hatch, the CEO of Tech Shop, hopes that the variety of projects happening at Tech Shop will make a difference in the area.
I want to see Detroiters change the world, and I think they can. It's just remarkable to see different kinds of projects come out of each of the shops. So I have no idea how they're going to do it. You know, the obvious answer would be, oh, they're going to do something in automotive. But, you know, people are way more creative than that, so I have no idea what they're going to do.
So whether it's making car parts or musical instruments, whether it's preserving or creating businesses, the so-called maker community is getting a chance to bring ideas to life, all under one roof. For Stateside, I'm Emily Fox.
There's no doubting the fact, were you to drive up and down the streets of Detroit, you'd likely see many areas that might bring to mind a moonscape instead of a neighborhood, the vacant buildings, the empty lots. But where many people look at these Detroit scenes and see ruins, others see opportunity and the chance to build a new kind of urban life from the ground up, an incredible experiment with the urban landscape. University of Michigan architecture professor Andrew Hersher has written a book about these urban pioneers out from the University of Michigan Press. It's called The Unreal Estate Guide to Detroit. And I started by asking Andrew just what unreal estate is.
Unreal estate is the name I give to urban space that's lost economic value to the point when it can support other sorts of values, values that are impossible to support when urban space functions as real estate.
So when it's functioning as real estate, we're looking at homes and businesses, and that's what it's there to support when we're saying it's real estate.
Exactly. And when people leave homes and when businesses fail and when property values decline, the buildings and the property that they occupy become available to be used and occupied and appropriated in different ways. And these are ways that are impossible to do and sometimes even to imagine in cities that function with a real estate market.
So when you're in an area, let's just contrast, let's say city of Chicago and its outlying areas, not that there aren't depressed and blighted neighborhoods there too, but there does seem to be much more in terms of functioning real estate there. But what I think I hear you're saying is because things have kind of caved in to such a point in many of Detroit's neighborhoods, it basically creates a blank slate.
Well, I wouldn't say a blank slate. Okay. What it does, and this is something that we know all too well, is it creates lots of problems. Mm-hmm. It creates empty neighborhoods. It creates disinvestment. It creates a declining tax base. Those are stories that we know very well.
Yes.
We're very aware of in Detroit. What I'm interested in is something else that it creates, which are conditions of possibility to live in the city differently and to do different things in the city. And unreal estate is the name I give for the platform for those other ways of imagining and inhabiting the city.
So give us a sense of what other ways of imagining and inhabiting a city are emerging even now, right? There are urban pioneers coming in and kind of applying their imagination and vision.
Yeah. Well, in Detroit, the individuals and the communities that have taken advantage of what I call unreal estate are really quite various. They include activists, artists, architects, anarchists, community groups, block clubs, outsider collectors and curators of urban ephemera, urban explorers, urban gardeners, urban scavengers, and many, many others, in fact. And they're all involved in what I see as a particular sort of informal, everyday urbanism that's availing itself of easily available urban space.
And this sounds like it is an interesting, eclectic mix of residents and newcomers.
Yeah. Like
room for everybody.
Well, I'm not sure everybody, but certainly a very diverse group of people and a very diverse set of interests. And what that yields is a very diverse set of projects and practices. In other words, some of the ways that unreal estate has been reappropriated are very small scale and ephemeral. Some of them are larger scale and longer term. Some are public, others are hidden. Some are legal, others are illegal. Some are what I regard to be very politically acute. Some are what I regard to be very politically naive. They all have in common an emergence in a city where urban space is far more available for reappropriation and reuse than in cities with intact functional real estate markets.
So we've kind of set the table with the fact that this unreal estate exists. So give us some examples, Andrew, of the kinds of projects that are starting to bubble up and really provide signs of hope for a new way of living in a big city.
Well, some examples of what I call unreal estate development are very well known to Detroiters. The Bog Center, for example, the Heidelberg Project, for example, the Earthworks Urban Farm. Others, I think, are known to more specific sorts of communities or interest groups. And actually, one of the things that the book tries to do is bring together projects and activities that usually, I think, are seen in isolation from one another.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, for example, in a discussion of what I call temporary communities, and these are communities that coalesce around events and then disperse after those events are over, I discuss John's Carpet House, which is a kind of open-air juke joint that takes place on a vacant lot in on the east side of Detroit on Sunday afternoons in the spring and the summer and the early fall. I also discuss a now regretfully shut-down project called Theater Bazaar, which is now taking place elsewhere and was closed down in 2010. Because they did not apply for the necessary permits to have a—
They were in abandoned houses and doing kind of a circus. I remember reading about this in the paper.
Absolutely.
So they didn't have the permits. And it leads me to wonder, how are these different kinds of projects being received by city officials, whether it's police, whether it's zoning officials, whether it's city hall?
In a real diversity of ways. But as the example of Theater Bazaar indicates, that unreal estate development is precarious. It's fragile. At times it's illegal or furtive. And so in a city like Detroit, those kinds of things can often take place without being noticed or regulated. But when they are noticed or regulated, then they sometimes disappear.
Okay. And it draws people to the area.
It draws people to the area, and then those people disperse. And this, I think, is one of the characteristics of unreal estate. Because a value doesn't have to be accrued in economic terms, then there's no need to do the kinds of things that you need to do.
No maintenance.
And very little investment, no need to amortize your investment and so forth and so on.
So that provides opportunities that would not exist, especially for young people.
Absolutely.
Trying to get whatever it is started out. If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty on Michigan Radio, and we're talking with University of Michigan architecture professor Andrew Hersher. You've given us in your book, The Unreal Estate Guide to Detroit, some really intriguing words and phrases. They were new to me, and I really found them intriguing. So I'd like you to explain them and give us some examples. Municipal therapy. I love that term.
Municipal therapy is what I call a process that takes place in a city like Detroit, where the city itself is not able to take care of its own resources, things like parks.
Keeping the grass mowed at a corner park.
Right. And what happens sometimes is that individuals and communities self-organize to take care of the city by themselves, for themselves.
Bottom up.
Yeah. And I think what happens then is people develop a very different sort of relationship to the city that they live in, because instead of delegating responsibility for maintaining and taking care of the city, they take on that responsibility for themselves.
And you've got a great photograph in your book of the Detroit Mower Gang. And there they are. And I also know the Navin Field grounds crew comes out and keeps the beloved field there, and they come down and play games. So that is all ground up kinds of things. Well, city's not going to do it, we're going to do it.
Yeah, and I think those are both great examples, because in both cases, those groups have a far more intimate relationship to the places that they take care of than you would have if they were merely using those places and then leaving them for somebody else to take responsibility for.
So let's flip over to Ruin Harvest.
Ruin Harvest is a term that I coined, and it describes a very different kind of relationship to abandoned and empty buildings. In a ruin harvest, ruins aren't either visualized as entrancing spectacles as they are in ruin porn, nor are they demolished as eyesores, which is something that the city of Detroit is doing. Instead, they are harvested to do things that you couldn't do with occupied inhabitable architecture. For example, in one project, the Firebreak project, which is conducted by the Detroit Collaborative Design Center at the University of Detroit Mercy, community groups get in contact with the design center to do something collectively with an abandoned or vacant building in their neighborhood. Mm-hmm. A building was converted into a kind of surface on which movies were projected so that open-air cinemas could take place during the summer. Other buildings were turned into platforms for a kind of open-air concerts. Hmm. And so there, in a sense, that's the kind of almost the direct opposite to ruin pornography, because there the ruin becomes something else, not a ruin, but a kind of active, functioning part of a neighborhood or a community.
As an architect, Andrew Hirscher, I want to ask you, when you drive around neighborhoods in the city of Detroit, and I'm sure other cities as well that have blighted areas, a lot of people would see blight and bad circumstances. Do you see hope?
I think it's all too easy to see signs of hopelessness in a city like Detroit. At the same time, I think it's all too easy to be naively hopeful about a city like Detroit. In other words, to see it as what's often called a blank canvas for artistic experimentation.
Yes.
I see Detroit as a very distinct phenomenon, a phenomenon in which there are possibilities to rethink, reimagine the city, and also very real conditions of suffering and impoverishment. And I think the challenge that Detroit presents us is to think those two conditions together. I should also say that my book is not intended to advance any sort of solution to the mm-hmm. very real problems that beset Detroit. I'm instead trying to document a condition. And I think it's a condition that's often overlooked or neglected, especially in narratives that pose Detroit as a kind of empty city or a vacant
right,
city
right.
or an abandoned city. I think if you look closely at Detroit, what you can see are spaces that might look empty from a distance, mm-hmm. but that they're actually occupied or used, albeit at times in very subtle, provisional, or hidden ways.
It almost maybe I'm wrong in this, but I almost get the sense it is not unlike a large urban laboratory where experiments in creative use can be tried out. So my question here then is, what kinds of takeaways, what kind of lessons can be learned from what's going here that could be applied to other cities that are depressed and blighted?
I'm trying to provide information and ideas to allow questions like that to be answered, and perhaps to prompt other sorts of questions mm-hmm. like that rather than to provide answers to them. But I do hope that it provides information and ideas that we can use to think about questions about how Detroit should move forward in a better way. Well, what's on the table right now, at least from the side of the city, is a kind of top-down planning. This is downsizing or mm-hmm. right-sizing. Now, advocates of downsizing or right-sizing might look at what my book documents, informal urban culture, as meaning not much of anything at all. But for those people who are looking for alternatives to top-down planning, then informal urbanism might actually present another way of surviving or even transforming Detroit, a way that relies on self-organization, bottom-up initiatives, informality, rather than the kind of formal processes that the city has on offer.
The book is The Unreal Estate Guide to Detroit. Professor Andrew Hirscher is the author, and he's an associate professor of architecture at the University of Michigan, also the co-founder of the Detroit Unreal Estate Agency, research on urban crisis using Detroit as such an important focal point. Thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
And as always, we love hearing from you. Got a good Michigan book you want us to know about? Maybe a story or a person you want spotlighted? Let us know. You can find us online, michiganradio.org. On Facebook, just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And on Twitter, we're to be found at Stateside Radio.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered today by Peg Watson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk again tomorrow at 3 o'clock.